And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Keith Law. Welcome to episode 97 of The Keith Law Show. I'm going to be joined today by Jason Kander, former Secretary of State of Missouri, the author of a great new book, Invisible Storm, A Soldier's Memoir of Politics and PTSD. All of his royalties from the book are going to the fight against veteran suicide and veteran homelessness. You can buy the book at InvisibleStormBook.com or at Bookshop.org or your local independent bookstore. You can also hear Jason's work on his podcast, Majority 54. For those of you who are subscribers to The Athletic, I had a new post up on Monday morning, a minor league scouting blog. I saw Kyle Harrison of the San Francisco Giants, as well as a couple of interesting Giants relievers, including RJ Davidovich, who was actually promoted to AAA right after the game. So I got there just in time. And Cole Waits, who has one of the best quality fastballs of anyone currently in minor league baseball, which makes him inherently interesting. I also saw Jay Groom and a brief look at Sidon Raffaella for the Red Sox and brought up a couple of Pirates prospects as well. And we'll have another post later this week on some Orioles, Phillies, and White Sox prospects, assuming that all goes well with the weather. And so far, it actually looks pretty good. I did have a new mock draft go up last week. That went up on Tuesday, I believe. I will do two more before we actually get to the draft proper. One probably about a week or so before the draft itself, and then one, I think we're currently scheduling it for the day before the draft. We will see, of course, how that pans out, but that is currently what we are hoping to do. Well, now it is my pleasure to be joined by Jason Kander, who is the author of a tremendous new book, Invisible Storm, A Soldier's Memoir of Politics and PTSD, which will be out extremely soon, actually, right? I believe the release date is next week, July 5th.
Yeah, so you're probably airing this when it's out, is my guess.
Yes, or maybe a few days before. So yeah. I'm holding the book up, although, of course, no one can see it except you.
Okay, but anyway. I appreciate it.
Yes, there you go. Yes, and by the way, Jason is on Twitter, at Jason Kander, K-A-N-D-E-R. Jason, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
So I usually avoid this question because I think it's a really hackneyed way to start an interview with an author. But in this case, I think it's applicable because you've talked about this quite a bit. Why did you decide to write this book?
Yeah, no, I think it's the right question. Because I felt like if this book had existed 14 years ago when I got back from Afghanistan, I would have read it and it would have spurred me to get treatment then, which would have kept things from getting as bad as they did for me. And I figure there's probably a lot of people out there who, I mean, I know there are, whether they're combat veterans or whether they are just, you know, victims of some kind of trauma, who are out there thinking, well, what I went through was not that bad. It doesn't really count. Or, you know, therapy probably wouldn't help me. Or, you know, from what I've seen on TV, people who experience trauma and get diagnosed with PTSD, like it doesn't turn out well for them. They rob banks or they, you know, they beat their spouse or they kill themselves. And certainly they don't get a job if they're public about it. And I just thought, well, you know, since there's no examples of post-traumatic growth out there, even though there are tons of people who are living post-traumatic growth walking around, we don't see those examples. They're not portrayed. I felt that I could do a service by demonstrating that it's a real thing and it's worth pursuing.
So the hardest part of dealing with mental illness might be accepting that you have one. You just talk about that. Just talked about that a second ago. I've written about that. I've a diagnosis of anxiety disorder. And between the social stigma that comes with mental illness, the feeling of personal failure or just weakness that comes with it, the thought that, like you said, well, this isn't going to get any better. Mm-hmm. All of these things, I think, prevent people from just saying, yes, I have a mental illness or I might have a mental illness. I should go get help. And you write multiple times in Invisible Storm about feeling like you didn't earn having post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm doing the air quotes around earn
sure.
for folks who can't see it. But this is a pretty recurrent theme within the book. Because of your specific military experiences, you felt like you didn't have the trauma to deserve, so to speak, having that diagnosis. So what would you say now to someone who's going through the same thing, who's has PTSD but won't sort of come to that conclusion themselves because they think they didn't have the trauma that merits the diagnosis?
Well, I talk to people about this all the time. And what I say is that trauma is trauma and that my brain doesn't know what your brain experienced. So comparing the two actually makes no sense. It doesn't do anything to give you perspective. It just delays your ability to heal. And for context for people listening, because, you know, I'm going to explain this in terms of, you know, my having thought I didn't earn it and mine is a military perspective. But I think the way our culture is sort of set up on this stuff, people will recognize it to some degree in their own lives regardless. But what the military does is this really like necessary form of brainwashing, which is from the moment you get off the bus at basic, you are told that what you're doing is no big deal and that most people have it worse. Somebody has it worse. And then that doesn't stop. Like you keep getting told that all the way through your deployment, all the way, your entire time you're in the service. And the reason I say it's necessary is because, you know, as an intelligence officer who had to go into meetings with people who might want to kill me and to be basically by myself with nobody to come and save me, you know, for me to keep going into those meetings and keep bringing back the information I could get from those meetings, I had to believe that what I was doing was not a big deal and didn't count. But the problem was, is nobody flipped that switch off when I left the military. Nobody was like, hey, by the way, that was a big deal. It wasn't until I sat down with a clinical social worker 11 years later at the VA who was like, yeah, you were in the most dangerous place on the planet, vulnerable for hours at a time, basically by yourself. Nobody knew where you were. Nobody was coming to back you up. And you were meeting with people who might want to kill you, which is why you wanted to sit down with them and get information. She was like, that was combat and it's trauma. And it took that for me to understand it. But when you, and that's, so that's the military version of it. But, you know, we're all walking around trying to gain perspective by feeling like, well, yeah, you know, I lost a loved one. You know, people will say things like, I lost a loved one, but it was to natural causes. You know, they weren't murdered. I know somebody who was murdered or, you know, I, whatever it is, it does, you know, you had a rough childhood, but you know, somebody whose was rougher. And that's the thing is, you know, a buddy of mine had at one point when he was trying to convince me to go get help, he said to me, look, somewhere there's a World War II vet who was at D-Day and was first wave, who's sitting in a VFW hall right now explaining, I was in the back of the landing craft. It's no big deal. and that's the thing. It's like, you're always going to find somebody who you think had it worse, but it's actually irrelevant because your brain didn't experience what they experienced and is totally unaware of it. And it's just experiencing what you experienced and is reacting to it the way that your brain is reacting to it. So you may as well deal with it.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of I'm married to a clinical psychologist also, so I've learned about a lot of this from her as well as stuff going through my own treatment too. But, you know, lots of people have what they call adverse childhood events, which can be things as serious. You know, you mentioned, you know, the people who were victims of abuse or who were witnesses to abuse in the home, but also things as small as your parents getting divorced when you're younger can qualify as an adverse childhood event. And those things are linked with greater risk of mental illness, as well as actually greater risk of substance abuse, which obviously can be self-medication, and physical illness. And we don't, I feel like we don't as a society just adequately tell people it's okay to be like this, to feel like this. You don't have to justify to anyone like you. You don't have to say, I was in this firefight. I was in this, you know, well, you were in combat, but you in your mind, it seems like had a very specific idea of what qualified as traumatic experiences in combat and what didn't, as if you were trying to justify to yourself. And I don't mean to put words in your mouth, tell me if you think this is accurate, but it's right. Did people, like, there's just this expectation that, well, this is what it is, right? This is what you either earned it or you didn't. And the more that we change the conversation where I'm trying to go with this around, no, it's okay. It doesn't matter what got you there. The point is you're here, acknowledging that you're here and are willing to get help. That's the first step. And if you can lead, it seems to me from the book, there's very much by sharing your experiences, you're trying to lead people to that point and recognize, you know, no, get walking in that door, metaphorical or literal, like you did at the VA, is that first step towards healing and personal growth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the other piece of it is just recognizing that time is not going to heal it. It's going to make it worse. And so the longer you spend trying to rank your trauma out of existence by explaining to yourself that it wasn't as big of a deal as somebody else's, that's just time going by that, one, you could have gotten treatment and be feeling better, but you're actually getting worse, which is why I compare it to any other injury, right? Like, you know, for me to go into the Army, I had to get surgery and physical therapy on my knee. Well, I suppose I could have just not told the Army that I had the injury I had, which was a torn ACL and meniscus. And I suppose I could have tried to go in and like do 15-mile ruck marches and, you know, several mile runs and all this crazy stuff with no ACL in my leg. But I think by the end of my service, if I had been able to hack it at all, which is doubtful, my leg would have been mangled and wouldn't work. And that's what I did with my brain for 11 years. As I went to Afghanistan, I sustained an injury to my brain through post-traumatic stress. And then I spent 11 years trying to walk it off. And the whole time, it was just getting worse and worse and worse. And so, you know, if I had just treated the injury initially, it would have been a different story. And that's a big thing I wanted to get across to people with the book as well is, you know, it's an injury. Don't think of it as different than it's an injury. Go treat it.
Yeah, if you're right, if you have a torn ACL, if you have cancer or diabetes, whatever, right, we still have this mindset that physical illness is, it's okay to have a physical illness. You know, people do not get embarrassed to say, I have cancer, but they do to say they have mental illness. And the other thing I find really fascinating about mental illness, as both somebody who suffers from it and just somebody who's kind of read a lot, try to learn more about it. I mean, it's what people like you and me do, right? I have this thing. I'm going to learn all the things about it.
Yeah, the need for control. I'm going to control it by knowing everything about it.
No question.
Yeah.
But that also, we find ways to sort of work around it. You discussed quite a bit in Invisible Storm that you had some really unhealthy coping mechanisms, probably not knowing the term until you got into treatment. I certainly didn't until I got into treatment. And then it's when the first time a therapist said coping mechanisms to me, it's like, oh, I have those.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't work. Right. But it turns out I have those. And one of your big ones, but certainly throwing yourself completely into work, and we're going to run for the next office, and I'm going to run the most diligent, forceful campaign I possibly can. What are some of the healthy ones that you've adopted since you've started getting treatment? To try to deal with this.
Sure. Well, let's start with the unhealthy ones, right? I mean,
sure.
I thought that I could heal myself through redemption. And there's a reason. I look back and I realize why we believe that. I mean, that is a huge part of the American myth, you know? I mean, when you think about, like, my son and I just went to see Top Gun Maverick the other day, and it's great, and we'll go see it again, you know? But the entire Top Gun story is built on the idea that, you know, you sustain this trauma, you lose your best friend. Mm-hmm. Well, the way to fix that is to go into battle and to defeat some bad guys, and then everything will be fine. And look, it's great to watch. I enjoy it. It's a great movie. Mm-hmm. But like, that's not how it works, right? I mean, I don't think I'm spoiling Top Gun 1. If you haven't seen it yet, you're probably not going to see it.
It's been 40 years. You're okay.
Exactly. But like, you know, literally, Goose dies and Viper walks in to deliver the news to Tom Cruise or to Maverick that Goose has died. And he says, Goose is dead. And then he says, look, if you serve long enough, this is going to happen. You got to get past it. Like, no. That's not how it works, man. Like, you got to go through it. You got to turn toward the trauma. You got to deal with it. It's going to take some time, but that time is going to be spent in therapy doing work. But that's not what we're taught. What we're taught is you go and you have a single act of heroic, redemption, and that's how you get better. And so that's, I think, what I was after, right? First it was, I'm going to save Missouri as a member of the state legislature. I'm going to pass all these reforms. And then that wasn't enough. So it was, I'm going to save voting rights in my state. I'm going to become the Secretary of State of Missouri, and that'll do it. And that wasn't enough. And then it was, well, I'll run for the U.S. Senate. I just barely lost in a state where it turned out there was no way I could have won at all. But, you know, then all of a sudden now I'm kind of famous. And the President of the United States is giving interviews where he says, like, I give him hope for the future. You know, Obama, not Trump. And then, to be clear, I meet with him and he's like, yeah, you should think about running. Like, you could do it. And then like, You know, in the meantime, I've got a lot of people paying attention to me. I got these famous people reaching out to me. I'm making all these famous friends, and that is filling me up, you know, for minutes at a time. And I'm feeling like, okay, maybe I'm not irredeemable. And so I start chasing the next endorphin high. So my coping mechanisms became performing, like giving big speeches or having big successes career-wise. And then that would carry me through to the next one. And eventually they just weren't lasting as long. And I couldn't control that. And that spiraled out of control for me to eventually when I had suicidal ideation. And this whole time, by the way, I'm not sleeping because I have violent nightmares. And I think that my family and I are in danger all the time because I have hypervigilance. Well, I went to therapy and I dealt with that stuff. It took me a few months, you know, and I still deal with some of that stuff, but I deal with it in a way where it's like my knee injury. I just, after I go for a run, I ice it. Like I know how to manage. So yep. To your question, what are the healthy coping mechanisms that I have now? They are largely centered around, and I think this is true for a lot of people, but I know it's true for somebody with my sort of PTSD, which is they are largely centered around my need for control. And I know that in my case, my need for a feeling of control of the situation comes from my experience in combat, which was I needed to know where all the doors were. I needed to know where all the ways in and out were. I needed to know how many guys there were in the room with me who were armed. How heavily armed were they? What was my assessment of how likely they were to become bad guys that I had to kill? How many more guys were there between me and my vehicle if I do decide to start shooting in this room? That kind of stuff, right? Well, that means that I learned in a period of 4 months that either you control every aspect of the situation or you die. So I'm aware that a lot of the time when I'm really upset or really stressed about something, I now know, thanks to therapy, that I'm probably trying to control a situation that I likely don't have control over. And the reason that my brain is wanting to control it is because my brain, at some level, you know, is inclined to believe that if I don't control things, I'll die. Now, how do I do that now? I do things like fitness and nutrition. Like, I get really into my workouts. Like, I plan them. They're on spreadsheets that I never use and that no one else ever sees, but I like entering the information into them. Yeah. I track for the last 3 years, I've tracked absolutely everything I've eaten in an app on my phone. You know, I'm not suggesting that other people do this, but I am saying, like, I've taken my learned desire for control, and I've tried to channel it into things that are productive for me, or at least good for my physical health. There are other things that I have to fight myself on. Like, you know, when my son gets on his scooter, which doesn't go more than 2 miles an hour, he's 8, and I want to be like, put on a helmet. When in reality, like, if I want him to wear his helmet on his bike all the time, I got to let him ride the freaking scooter in the driveway with no helmet, right? So it's learning what I can control and what I can't, and then trying to, what works for me is I like to keep my body moving. So like now, you know, I love baseball. So like I coach my son's little league team and I play on a over 30 wood bat baseball team, and you know, having hobbies, which I didn't know were a thing you could have until I went to therapy, you know, like stuff like, hey, okay, I got 3 games this week that I'm playing in. Let's see. Okay, Monday I'm going to hit the cages. Oh, there's an hour Tuesday where I can, you know, working on things that ultimately in the larger world don't matter, but it's not harmful to anybody if I try to exercise a lot of control over it.
Yes, that actually makes a ton of sense to me because I have a lot of hobbies. My wife mocks me a lot. She says you have more outside interests than most adults she knows. Of course, I work from home a lot.
Well,
you can see the guitars behind me. Yeah, I see the guitar there. Yeah. That's a big one. I play board games a ton. I've ended up sort of turning that into – I review board games quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Because I can't like not write about them.
Sure,
I mean, yeah. That's my one thing is if you give me a book, a movie, a record – not that people listen to whole albums anymore, but I used to do that. Board games, whatever. It's like – and now I have to write about it. That is the compulsion. But it turns out it's very – I hate to overuse the word, but in the sort of colloquial sense, it is kind of therapeutic. It's very relaxing to me to do that, and it doesn't matter. Right. What I say about this movie, especially with movies, nobody cares what I say. There are actual professional movie critics out there. Listen to them, not me. But I get something out of that.
Yeah.
And it takes me out of the, you know, I have work stress. I like my job a lot, but I have work stress like everybody else has. Mm-hmm. And I had, you know, and there are just the stresses of daily life. And, you know, I do the same thing. I'm right now, I feel compelled to apologize to you. My life isn't that bad, though.
Right. See, everybody does that.
Right. But having those as a They are distractions, but they're good. We tend to associate, that's a pejorative term, right? It's a distraction. It's what that, therefore it's bad for you, or it's trivial. Yeah, you know what? I'm not changing the world by playing Settlers of Catan or Ticket to Ride, but I really like it actually. And it takes me out of myself, out of the world for a little bit. And when I'm done with that, I just feel better in the sense that, like a lot of people, you know, whether it's taking a nap, going for a run, or some of the unhealthy coping mechanisms where they think they feel better afterwards.
Well, and here's what I've learned about it. I learned the term in therapy, avoidance, which mm-hmm. is to say, I now I've learned the difference between when my coping mechanisms or my hobbies or whatever, when they are avoidance and when they are a hobby. So look, when there are times when I'll sit there and I will work on a little league lineup for 2 hours, shuffling things around, going, okay, well, this kid, you know, we could try him at first base. How's he going to do? And all that. When I could probably get the thing done in 30 minutes. And my wife will say, like, okay, what are we avoiding right now? Right? Because maybe, you know, there was some news about what went on in Afghanistan, or there was something else I find triggering, like there was a school shooting somewhere, or maybe it's just, you know, I'm upset because I had a conversation with a buddy that upset. Whatever it is, I've learned, oh, okay, sometimes my hobbies are avoidance and I shouldn't let them be that, right? So I will talk with my wife is a real saint about how many conversations she'll have with me about either my team, my baseball team, or my son's baseball team, or the Royals farm system. Yeah. Because right now we're mostly talking about either Bobby Witt Jr. or the farm system. Yep. And, you know, she's really great about that. But there's also a point where she's like, hey, I would like to talk about something else now. And I recognize that sometimes that's because I just want to open my MLB app and watch highlights for 30 minutes because I don't want to deal with the world. And that's when I have to go, oh, okay, that means I need to deal with the world right now.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm glad you brought up baseball a couple times too, because I did want to ask, you talk quite a bit in the book about it, about your Royals fandom. I'm curious, what did little Jason Kander think when he was going to grow up? I'm assuming you at some point entertained fantasies of being a Major League Baseball player. We all did, until I stopped growing at least and realized, oh, literally everybody in Major League Baseball is taller than I am, except Jose Altuve. I have one.
Who swings a 35-inch bat somehow. So, right? I mean, like, what are we doing?
He's got 25 pounds of muscle on me, so it's not really a fair comparison. Still, if I had to go for a body comp, oh my God, it is unbelievable.
Yeah.
He is, I say, a freak in a loving way.
He's
in
an alien.
The best possible way.
Yeah.
So what did little Jason Kander think was his baseball future, though? What was the dream? A game or a position? What was it going to be?
Oh, it's quite simple. Until I was 15 years old, I was going to play center field for the Kansas City Royals. Like, it's not, I mean, no hesitation, that was the plan. Like, that was the plan.
Yep.
And then at 15, I realized, oh, I've been 5'10" for a couple of years, and I think this is where I'm going to stay. And I, depending on where the sun is, sometimes I'm 5'11". But, but yeah, that's what happened. And, yeah, I mean, that was what it was going to be. I had a very funny conversation recently with my dad where, I mentioned I play on this team. We have this team called the Kansas City Hustlers, and we play in the National Men's Adult Baseball League. And we actually, you know, we have a social media presence, and some folks come out to the games occasionally and stuff. And I play center field, and it's, you know, I didn't play. I went to a school that didn't have a college that didn't have a team. Mm-hmm. I think I probably could have played like D2 or something, But most of the guys, almost everybody on this team and most of the guys we play against played at least college ball. Some of them played a little pro and stuff. And my dad joked recently, he was like, you know, it's funny. He goes, you did all this stuff. And, you know, you were Secretary of State. You did all these things. He goes, and at the end of the day, you landed where you wanted to, which is you play center field for Kansas City's baseball team. It's just in a different league than you had in mind. And and I was like, yeah, that is kind of what I did. So it worked out.
That works. Absolutely. At least you got, you're still playing, which is more than certainly most of us. I reached the point very early. It was clear that was not the future. So it became, well, maybe I can find some
you found way your way
to
into
work
the game.
In baseball.
Yeah. You found your way into the game, man. I mean, yeah, but no, it's, and that's what so many of us are trying to do. It's just find our way to stick around the game.
Yeah. Well, there's that little part of me that thinks back to 8-year-old Keith Law, who, you know, back at that point, I was short, but so was everybody, so it didn't matter. Yeah. The differences were much less at that point. Yeah, but if I had said to him, hey, you're going to get paid to watch and write about baseball, I think I would have said, oh, that's pretty good, actually.
And like talk to ball players and get to know them and you can go, you know, and all that stuff. And
yeah,
that's, you know, when I was Secretary of State, I wrote this column. I called, so it was 2014. It was right before opening day 2014. Mm-hmm. So if you remember, that's when the Royals, you know, they went to the World Series that year, but didn't win. And then they won the next year. But Kansas City had at that point been through 29 years of no playoff baseball. And everybody was like, the Royals seem like they might be good, but I don't believe it. And so I called up the editor of the Kansas City Star and I was like, hey, I would like to write an op-ed that is not about politics. I just want to write about the Royals. And he's like, well, okay, write it up and submit it. And I wrote it and it was pretty good. And the whole idea was like, look, for real, this is the year. Like, it's okay. Yeah. It's okay to have hope. And they published it on opening day in the sports section. And for me, like, that's one of the coolest things I got to do as Secretary of State of Missouri. And like, that's what you get to do all the time, is just write about sports.
Yeah, I'm very lucky. I always say I don't complain about my job because nobody wants to hear it. I have one friend in particular who's like, you write about baseball. Shut up.
Well, you know, every job has its things. But
yes, of course. The last question I want to ask you is, you know, as we're talking, we've had some, let's say, unfortunate Supreme Court decisions come down the last couple of days. And you were on that treadmill for a while. And you say at the end of the book, it's, you're not ruling out possibly returning to politics, but it's not imminent, which I can certainly understand. But what would you say to people, especially younger than us, who are upset about the state of the world, state of the country, especially, in, you know, feeling like there's nothing they can do, or what could they possibly do about it? Thinking back to sort of where you were, maybe 20-ish years ago.
A couple of things. One, I think that one of the greatest breaks in our country right now is cultural, and I don't mean in the way that, like, when there's a mass shooting, people who don't want to do anything about gun safety say like, oh, this is a cultural issue. I don't mean that. What I mean is that we have a cultural rift that's keeping us from solving these big problems that are, it's pretty evident how to solve some of the problems in our democracy, right? Like gerrymandering, the way primaries work, voter suppression, money in politics, like that stuff. It's not like we don't know what the solutions are. But what's keeping us from doing that stuff is a lack of ability to see humanity in people who are not on the same side of things as us. Now, again, I haven't stated anything that people don't know, but where I think that stems from in a large way is that this is the longest period in the history of our country, the longest consecutive period, without some form of mandatory service, which is not to say that we need to put everybody into the military, or necessarily even that we need to have a mandatory service requirement, although I do think we should have one. But what we really, really need is some sort of system that at least incentivizes people at a very young age, like right out of high school or right out of college or during those would be those college years if they would have chosen to go, to spend some time working side by side people who they have almost nothing in common with. Because when you think about my path, look, I'm a white guy from the suburbs of Kansas City who came from a family that had done pretty well. And if I had not chosen to go into the military after 9/11, I don't know what my perspective on things would be, right? But because I served, it was military, but you could take that out of it. Regardless, I served with people from every background, And as a result, like when I see things that afflict different parts of the country, I feel a connection to those parts, whether they be regional or demographic, it doesn't matter. And, you know, we live in a time where it's very hard to define what it is to be an American, right? It's like 1 in 3 people watch the Super Bowl. Everybody knows who The Rock is and they have an opinion on Taylor Swift. And other than that, like, it ain't like it used to be where you could say to somebody, well, what'd you do during the war? Whether they were a man or a woman, right?
Right.
And then you would go to work and there was a 1 in 3 chance you watched the same thing on TV last night. Well, we're not going to change those things. I don't think we should go into a world war to do it. And and we're not going to get rid of the, you know, the way that technology has changed. So what we have to do is we have to create a culture where people know people who are not like them. And so that they can't just do the thing that we have a tendency to do, speaking of avoidance, which is just write off things that happen to other people as things that happen to them wouldn't happen to me, and probably it was their fault, right? Because that's easier on our brain. It's easier mm-hmm. for us to handle emotionally. But the good news is, like you said, what would I say to young people? The good news is when I talk to people in Generation Z, I feel like they already get this, whether they, you know, think that we should have mandatory service or not. Like, they get that people should be more connected than they are. And actually, whereas social media and technology tends to push us apart, I find that a lot of the time they are using it to bring themselves closer to other people, and that's their interest in it. And that makes me feel really optimistic, you know, that there's a greater interest and a greater willingness in learning about people that you don't have physical proximity to.
My guest today has been Jason Kander. He is the author of the new book, Invisible Storm, A Soldier's Memoir of Politics and PTSD, out on July 5th. You can find Jason on Twitter and on Instagram at Jason Kander, K-A-N-D-E-R. Jason, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That's all for this week's show. Thank you all so much for listening. Again, you can check out Jason's book, Invisible Storm. It is available at invisiblestormbook.com. I recommend bookshop.org or find an independent bookstore near you. We are big fans of indie bookstores here at The Keith Law Show. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Stay safe.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a 1-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a 1-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.